I've shared with you before that I do not like preaching about money, whether about giving or being generous, or especially when a text happens to be about paying those the church sets apart for preaching and teaching. There are worse topics, of course. When we were in Judges 19 several weeks ago, that was a text I told you at the time that I would rather preach about money than that particular text, and I meant it. But we come today to the second half of the second chapter of the book of Ruth. It's a lovely text. We see God's people acting like God himself, doing the very thing he gave them to do. It's a beautiful story about kindness to foreigners, about generosity to strangers, about Israel showing the world what God is like. As we will see, the generosity on display in our text is profound. The problem is, I think I would rather preach Judges 19 again. You see, as much as I may agree intellectually with this text, I don't really believe it. Now, in my head, it's a wonderful text. I would readily affirm everything it teaches us about God and what it means to live in his kingdom, unless it applies to me. See, then my lived experience makes living by faith so much more difficult, for my heart is prone to wander after vain things. I've experienced God's generosity many times. That's not the issue. My problem is God is usually not generous in the time or in the manner I want him to be generous. Even though when he is generous, it is overwhelming. For example, in 2014, Donnie and I were planning to celebrate our 20th wedding anniversary. One Sunday morning, we were still at Palmer Elementary at the time. One Sunday morning, someone asked us about what our plans were. 20 seemed to them to be a big number, and it did seem like a huge number at the time, although we were so young then. New City was only 3 years old, and therefore had a limited budget, which meant my wife and I had a much more limited budget. So we were happily planning to go out to a really nice budget restaurant for supper, and then eat mac and cheese the rest of the week. We had seen God provide in amazing ways for us prior to this. We were not complaining that morning about our plans in any way. We were excited for being able to celebrate 20 years of marriage, regardless of how we celebrated. I mean, I was especially grateful that in 20 years she hadn't smothered me with a pillow in my sleep. Well, the fact is, God had been extraordinarily kind in multiple ways over those 20 years, and we were truly thankful for all he had given us, even a nice meal at a budget restaurant. Well, one individual who was there that day overheard the conversation, and he told us we couldn't celebrate that way. I don't really have many options. We were looking forward to a nice evening out together. We assured him we were great with those plans. He insisted, however, and he told us he would take care of the details. The next thing we knew, we were staying at the Waldorf Astoria Hotel in Chicago, all expenses paid, in a suite that was actually larger than our first apartment. In fact, the shower in this apartment was larger than our first bedroom. We had generous gift cards from this man to eat at restaurants we would never be able to afford in Chicago. He gave us spending money. That's crazy. He even provided a really nice car for us to drive there, which that one we're kind of thankful for because we really weren't looking forward to the valet parking attendant parking our hoopty minivan. Again, not that we're complaining about that hoopty minivan. That too had been a gift from God. We were overwhelmed by the extravagance of God's kindness to us. If this man had simply offered us a gift card to a nice restaurant locally, we would have been ecstatic. That would have been absolutely incredible. So the 3 days in this luxury hotel were truly over the top. When I say it's a luxury hotel, it's so luxury, they don't even let you tip. And they do everything for you. Oh, pardon me, sir. You want me to tie your shoe for you? Like, it was crazy how well they treated us. So here we are. In a text about the generosity of God on display in his people, and I don't really believe it. I've experienced it. As I've told you, we stayed at the nicest hotel we've ever imagined staying at, all expenses paid. I also mentioned the van God had given us. Literally, God had given us that van. But see, the problem with the human heart, and what I mean by that is the problem with my human heart, is how quickly it descends into the spiral of, what have you done for me lately? We can have faith God will provide, and we will be happy, provided He provides in the time and manner of our choosing, whether that provision is for financial resources or health or the sort of relationships we want or the pace of career advancement, etc. If God will give us what we want when we want it, we will gladly praise Him for it. This is the idol my heart truly worships. This morning, we're going to see God's incredible generosity in the life of a foreigner in Israel. We will see how God continued to pile up kindness after kindness on top of His kindnesses. And then we're going to see what it means for us. So we are in Ruth chapter 2, beginning in verse 14. And at mealtime, Boaz said to her, "Come here and eat some bread and dip your morsel in the wine." So she sat beside the reapers, and he passed to her roasted grain. And she ate until she was satisfied, and she had some left over. When she rose to glean, Boaz instructed his young men, saying, "Let her glean even among the sheaves, and do not reproach her. And also pull out some from the bundles for her, and leave it for her to glean, and do not rebuke her." So she gleaned in the field until evening. Then she beat out what she had gleaned, and it was about an ephah of barley. And she took it up and went into the city. Her mother-in-law saw what she had gleaned. She also brought out and gave her what food she had left over after being satisfied. And her mother-in-law said to her, "Where did you glean today? And where have you worked? Blessed be the man who took notice of you." So she told her mother-in-law with whom she had worked and said, "The man's name with whom I work today is Boaz." And Naomi said to her daughter-in-law, "May he be blessed by the Lord, whose kindness has not forsaken the living or the dead." Naomi also said to her, "The man is a close relative of ours, one of our redeemers." And Ruth the Moabite said, "He said to me, you shall keep close by my young men until they have finished all my harvest." And Naomi said to Ruth, her daughter-in-law, "It is good, my daughter, that you go out with his young women, lest in another field you be assaulted." So she kept close to the young women of Boaz, gleaning until the end of the barley and wheat harvests. And she lived with her mother-in-law. When God rescued Israel out of Egypt, remember, he led them to Mount Sinai. There at Mount Sinai, God would give Israel an incredible gift. He would enter into a covenant agreement with them. He would be their God. He would dwell among them in the tabernacle. By dwelling in the tabernacle, God could be close to Israel, and Israel could be close to God. Not too close, because that would be dangerous. So with the priesthood in place and the tabernacle in place, Israel would be safe while also having God in their midst. In response to who God is and what he would do for them, Israel was to become like him. See, the covenant is the Ten Commandments. Moses would refer to the Ten Commandments as the tablets of the covenant. In fact, in Exodus 34, when God gave him the replacement set after he broke it because of the golden calf, the text says, he wrote on the tablets the words of the covenant, the Ten Commandments. These commandments described God and his character in the form of instructions. Fact is, Israel should not murder, not because a rule said they should not murder. Israel shouldn't murder because God is not the sort who would take life unjustly. They know this because he said, don't murder. Israel should not lie or steal or cheat because God is the sort who would not do these things. By keeping these commandments, Israel wasn't simply being obedient. They were actually becoming like Yahweh, their God. The whole point of the covenant was for Israel to be holy, for God is holy. As we've seen in Judges, however, Israel was not holy. Throughout their time in the wilderness, they rebelled against God. In fact, during the initial days when Joshua led them into the land, they were more or less faithful-ish to the law, but then Joshua died. The very next generation did not know the Lord. They rebelled against everything their parents had experienced with God. They worshiped and served other gods, completely rejecting the God who had given them the land. And this did not go well. They were frequently oppressed, and they frequently suffered. Remember, as we've seen, God's default mode is to bless. I feel it already. God's default mode is to bless. He claimed them as his people in order to bless them. But to receive the blessings, Israel must first receive God himself. God is the blessing he offered them. To reject him is to reject his blessings while also pursuing those material blessings in other ways. As we've seen in the book of Judges, this did not go well. We've seen throughout the time of the Judges that Israel was largely unfaithful, and so Israel largely did not receive the covenant blessings. This is how the story of Ruth begins. Israel was suffering. Some scholars believe Ruth existed during the time of Gideon. The Midianites were stealing their crops right at harvest, and so there wasn't enough food. In response to this, a man named Elimelech takes his wife Naomi and two sons, and he went to Moab because apparently they weren't stealing grain in Moab. Well, in time, he died, his sons married Moabite women, then his sons died, leaving Naomi and her two daughters-in-law. One returned home to find another husband, but Ruth insisted on following Naomi back to the land of Israel because Naomi had heard the Lord's blessings were abundant in the land once again. Again, this is likely after Gideon's success in defeating the Midianites. We saw last week that Ruth was able to work in the fields harvesting crops she did not plant. The law said that widows and orphans and sojourners, poor people, foreigners, right? People like Ruth were allowed to profit off the hard work of others. These are known as the gleaning laws. We read this in Leviticus 19. When you reap the harvest of your land, you shall not reap your field right up to its edge, neither shall you gather the gleanings after your harvest. And you shall not strip your vineyard bare, neither shall you gather the fallen grapes of your vineyard. You shall leave them for the poor and for the sojourner. I am Yahweh your God. Notice God identifies himself after giving this instruction to them. The reason they are to leave behind some of the harvest in the fields and some of the produce in their vineyards and orchards for others to gather wasn't because there was a law requiring that they do so. The reason given is Yahweh is God. Because I am Yahweh, because of who I am, because of what I'm like, you should be like me, and I am the sort who would leave plenty for others. Israel must also take care of the poor and the sojourner because God takes care of the poor and the sojourner. This was in the days of the judges, however, and it's not a given that the Israelites would be keeping laws like this one. Again, we saw that Ruth asked permission to glean along the edges of the field, and this permission was granted. So she began gathering the bits that were left behind as the workers harvested in the center of the field. In her case, she was poor and a sojourner and a widow, but she worked hard and she began to impress other people in the field. And as Will shared last week, it just so happens she found herself in a field belonging to a man named Boaz. Boaz told her she had come to find refuge under the wings of Yahweh, God of Israel, for she was a convert to Israel, a worshiper of the God of Israel. And so she was not treated like a foreigner, but like one who belonged. Our text picks up here. Boaz has instructed her to stay in his fields, to remain near his young women from his extended household, but also from his clan, people he knew and trusted, along with others he knew and trusted, to work in his harvest. And then, this is amazing, like Jesus with the Samaritan woman, Boaz offers to let her drink from the same cup he and his men were drinking from, further indicating his acceptance of her and his welcome of her. Well, then mealtime arrives. Verse 14 seems to indicate Ruth is keeping her distance. The fact that she needs to be called near indicates she's keeping her distance. The text doesn't indicate she brought herself a lunch. She was quite poor, after all. They had just traveled from Moab. She probably doesn't have one. And being a single woman and being a foreigner, being well aware of her own status in the world, she understands how vulnerable she is. This is the world in which an Israelite man would offer his own daughter as a sacrifice. This is the world in which a Levite would offer his concubine, his second wife, to the ravenous wolves, and after they killed her, he would chop up her body in order to summon an army to go get the guys that he gave her to. This is a world in which a man like Samson, called by God to be a leader of his people, would simply demand a woman be given him, and she would be. Ruth knows her place. Boaz knows it differently. In verse 14, he calls her to join him and his people. Don't stay by yourself, Ruth. Come over here and join us. You're part of us now. The ESV says he tells her to eat some bread, but it's more literally, come here and eat from the bread, indicating specific bread is in mind. It is bread that he has provided for his people, for his workers, for his employees. Now, understand that in our world, many today would call her a moocher, a deadbeat. She's kind of lazy. You see, she didn't plow that field. She didn't plant that field. She didn't water and nurture that field as it grew. She just showed up during harvest expecting to profit off everyone else's work. However, that is not how Boaz saw it. Not only does she have a right to his crop, he shows even more generosity to her and gives her the bread he has provided for his workers. But then he tells her to dip her morsel into the wine. And we're not really sure what this is. It could be some sort of wine sauce or maybe a vinegar-based sauce. Some wonder if it's like a forerunner of hummus that's been flavored with wine. We don't know. But whatever it is, it appears to be something like a condiment, something that makes the bread even better. So there she is, an immigrant sitting beside the reapers as one who belonged. Again, she's well aware of who she is. She's well aware of who they are. And yet, Boaz is treating her as one who belonged there. And then he demonstrated even more generosity by passing roasted grain to her. The author says she ate until she was satisfied and had some left over. That means he didn't pass her a bowl of roasted grain. That was sort of a community bowl. Take a couple scoops and pass it on. He gave her some sort of container filled with roasted grain. That's her food now. He's given her this incredible gift. She had so much roasted grain that there were leftovers, which means she now has a meal to take home to her mother-in-law, Naomi. But Boaz isn't finished with his kindness and generosity. As she's getting up after lunch to go back to work in the field, Boaz speaks directly to his young men, to his employees, right in front of her. He makes sure she can hear his instructions to them and therefore his instructions to her. Notice carefully what he says. She must be allowed to glean even among the sheaves. See, normally a gleaner would work the edges of the field. Right, the Israelites were told to leave the edges unharvested. As they would cut the barley or the wheat or whatever the crop is, they would bundle it together. These would be tied into these bigger bundles called sheaves. Then workers would go into the field and they stick a pole under one, a pole under the other. They could carry out two of these large sheaves. When Moses gave the instructions for gleaning a second time in the book of Deuteronomy, it's a repeat of the law, he actually further clarified what Leviticus 19 meant, and it's even more detailed about what Israel is to do with their harvests. Moses said, this is God speaking, when you reap your harvest in your field and forget a sheaf, that massive amount of food in the field, you shall not go back for it to get it. It shall be for the sojourner, the fatherless, and the widow, that the Lord your God may bless you in all the work of your hands. When you beat your olive trees, you shall not go over them again. It shall be for the sojourner, the fatherless, and the widow. When you gather the grapes of your vineyard, you shall not strip it afterward. It shall be for the sojourner, the fatherless, and the widow. You shall remember that you were a slave in the land of Egypt. Therefore, I command you to do this. So as they were gathering their sheaves, it'd be easy to miss some. You got a whole people group in the line. You're kind of talking. You turn your back and you forget one. God says, you can't go back for that one. It no longer belongs to you. This is for other people that I'm providing for. Instead, the sojourner, the fatherless, the widow had a right to it. He says they must not gather every bunch of grapes. Not all grapes ripen at the same time. So you go through your field once, your vineyard one time. You pick the ripe ones. And then a week later, if the other half of the vineyard has ripened, those aren't your grapes anymore. The poor, the fatherless, the widow, the sojourner has a right to come in and harvest those now ripe grapes. See, it would be so easy to focus on leaving the edges of the field while you focus on maximizing the profit in the bulk of your field. But God says it's not about maximizing profit. It's about providing for those in need. The spirit of the law was to be like the Lord, and the Lord is the sort who provides for those in need. Now, ordinarily, a gleaner would work behind the reapers, gathering what fell and didn't quite make it into those bundles, and those bundles, the bits that didn't quite make it into the sheaves. And of course, any sheaf that was mistakenly left behind for others. Boaz chooses to be like God and tells his men to let her gather with them. As the barley is being cut, she can grab all she wants. Not just the leftovers, not just the part that got stepped on. She is to work right there with them where the good stuff is being cut. In other words, Boaz says, let her harvest, not merely glean. But that's not all. In verse 16, he tells them again, this is in front of her, giving her instructions as well. He tells his men, pull some out from the bundles and give them to her. See, as the crop was being cut, the others are right there with them, gathering them into piles. Someone else is gathering those piles and tying them into these sheaves and stacking them up so they can dry. When the whole field was cut, they'd come back and gather all the sheaves. They were to leave even more for Ruth to gather for herself. But then he says, he gives two more instructions. She must be allowed to glean at the front of the harvest as they're cutting the barley. But he says they must not reproach her for doing this. That is, they must not mock her. They must not make fun of her. They must not make her feel poor. They must not act as if she were an outsider. Act as though she were one of us. You see, the last thing a poor person needs, a poor person who's receiving charity, is to be made to feel poor. Boaz says, don't do that to her. Treat her like she's one of us. And when he told them to pull out some of the bundles, he added, and do not rebuke her. If she happens to grab another handful, don't rebuke her. If you think she's taking too much, don't rebuke her. Let her harvest alongside you. See, in a subtle way, Boaz is reminding his men, the harvest isn't theirs. This isn't their field. This isn't their crop. He's also not claiming that it's his crop, because Boaz knows the Lord is the one who has given the crop in the first place. God is the one who is blessing. And so Boaz insists his men allow her to share in the same blessing. So Ruth gleans until evening, and then she begins to beat out the wheat she had gathered. What was collected was stalks of barley. So we have a video. They would use flails, and they would hit it. Sometimes if there was more, they'd use threshing sledges. It's called threshing. But they would beat the grains bits of grain off of the stalks. They would remove the stalks, and what's left behind is the actual food. The grain is the food. The author says she harvested, this way, about an ephah of barley. What? It's kind of like saying your car gets, you know, about 4 kilometers per liter. Is that good? No, it's about 10 miles per gallon. But how would you know? We don't use those measurements. An ephah of grain is about 30 pounds. Again, we don't tend to buy grain, so this measurement is hard to grasp. We don't have a reference point for how much she harvested in a single day. So here it is. She harvested enough food to feed 2 adults for an entire week. That's an extraordinary amount. This is more than most men would harvest in a single day. In fact, in 1 Samuel 17, we have the story of young David. You got the Philistines out with Goliath. David's 3 older brothers are at the battlefield. David's a little boy. And like, hey, his dad says, hey, take your brother some food. So he takes some bread. He takes some cheese, some other things. But he also takes an ephah of grain. Ruth harvested enough food for 3 soldiers in one day. Such was the generosity of Boaz. In verse 18, she takes this heavy amount of food home. Remember, it's the ephah of barley she's harvested, plus the roasted grain that's left over. She takes it home. Naomi saw how much she had harvested, and she saw the grain, the roasted grain she had been given, and she exclaims, "Where did you glean today?" It really has the more of the tone of, "Where in the world did you go today? Where did you get all this stuff? Who is the guy who took notice of you?" See, Naomi understands this isn't a normal amount of grain to harvest in a single day. Oh, and you got roasted grain? What? Well, she further adds, "Blessed is the man who took notice of you." See, the only way she could have gathered that much barley, threshed that much barley, that's knocking the grain from the stalk, and then winnowed that much, that's separating the chaff from the grain, was if someone had helped her. So she calls upon the Lord to bless whomever showed her this level of generosity. It is amazing to me how a single act of generosity can push away the pain of bitterness. Remember, this is Naomi, whose name means pleasant. She tried to rename herself Mara. "Don't call me pleasant, call me bitter. My life is bitter." But now she knows God has rejected her name change. God will not call her bitter. He will call her pleasant. Well, Ruth responds to Naomi's incredulity by giving the man's name. It's like, "Oh, I was with some guy named Boaz. Seemed really nice. I don't know." Naomi knows Boaz. You see, he and her late husband are from the same clan. He's a close relative. But she also, Naomi, knows the law of Moses. Because family lines were important to covenant blessings, a family line needed to be maintained. As a widow, she was facing having to sell her husband's ancestral lands. Only a kinsman redeemer could purchase that land on behalf of her dead husband so that his name would continue. Boaz happens to be one of those close family members. Ruth blows right past that. She doesn't understand what Naomi is suggesting. I mean, remember, she's a new convert. She doesn't understand the implications for herself and for her future. When Naomi tells her that Boaz happens to be a close relative, she assumes, "Oh, that explains his generosity to me. That must be why he told me to stick with his men during the entire harvest, not just today. We're family. That makes sense." Naomi is floored by the man, by who the man is, while Ruth is floored by the man's generosity. Remember, he told her to continue harvesting with his men through both harvests. There was the barley harvest, and then afterward, the wheat harvest. Now think of this. If she could, in a single day, harvest enough grain for her and Naomi for an entire week, what would 60 days of harvest provide? 60 weeks. That's more than a year. Harvest could easily be 3 months long, which means she and Naomi will have so much food that they'll be able to sell it so they can buy other things that they need. Naomi tells her it's good for you to stay by the young women. Now, Ruth was told to stay by the young men, but Naomi says to stay by the young women. It is the time of the judges, after all. Young men, or men, frankly, of any age, can be very dangerous to a young woman like Ruth. So she's told, stay with his young women, because in another field, bad things could happen. Naomi knows Boaz, and she knows he is a good man who will protect her. So Ruth did what she was told. Verse 23 tells us she finished the barley harvest. Normally there's a break between the barley harvest where you can thresh and then winnow the grain, and then you'd start the wheat harvest. But the harvest was so good, they seem to have blurred right into one another. They just finished the barley, and they don't have time to finish the barley, to winnow it and thresh it, so they move right on to the wheat harvest. We see that in chapter 3. There was so much barley to harvest, it went right up to the wheat harvest. So Ruth spends these 3 months or so working with Boaz and his crew, caring for her mother-in-law, and taking refuge under the wings of the God of Israel. I struggled with this text all week. I had a horrible week. I was a bear to be around. Donna told me to put that exact line in there. I was a bear to be around. The problem wasn't that I didn't understand the text. The problem was that I did understand it, and therefore I understood what it revealed about me. See, we tend to think generosity is, there's our smarty word for the kiddos. We tend to think generosity is primarily about giving financial resources. It does include that, but it is so much more than money. The truth is, God gives himself. God is generous with himself. This generosity ought to motivate our generosity. In fact, when the Apostle Paul was collecting resources, money to send to the church in Jerusalem, they were going through a famine. They were the mother church. He wanted to love them well. He could have simply ordered his churches to give money to support the Israelite, to the Jerusalemites. Remember, he told Philemon he had the authority to order him to free his slave Onesimus. But he said, I don't want to order you. I want you to choose to do what is right. And so through your choice, honor the Lord. And we know from history, he did, in fact, free him. When it came to this collection, though, he chooses, I'm not going to use my apostolic authority. Instead, what does he do? How does he motivate the churches? He says things like this, like he said in 2 Corinthians. He said, for you know the grace of our Lord Jesus Christ, that though he was rich, yet for your sake he became poor, so that you, by his poverty, might become rich. You probably know the story of the rich young ruler, this guy who claimed he had kept the law, wants to know what he must do to inherit eternal life. Jesus said, yeah, you've kept the commandments except one. You forgot the big one being, go and sell everything that you have and give the money to the poor. Where does it say that? Well, everywhere. The man went away sad because he was very rich. Paul says, Jesus was simply telling the rich young ruler, be like me. I'm the sort who would give away everything I have for the good of others. If you really want to enter the kingdom, you have to be like me. You've got to trust me. I have to become your identity in life. Do what I would do, he says. Fact is, Jesus gave up everything for his people. This motivates and compels our own generosity, but generosity is about more than just money. See, we fail to remember this, and so we sometimes desire God's stuff more than we desire God. God is most generous with himself because he promises he would never withhold himself from anyone who comes to him in faith. That stuff we want, the stuff we'd rather have, is often financial resources, whether it's a cash or a car or a house or a vacation or retirement funds. But it's also other stuff that we want from God. We want God to be generous in other ways. Good health. Why can't I have a relationship like theirs? Why can't I have children like theirs? Why can't I have a job like that? Why can't I be physically attractive? Why can't I have peace of mind? Why can't I have freedom to travel around? We wonder why God didn't give us parents like he gave this other guy. Why does this other guy get to be super attractive and super athletic and fit? Why does she get to be so pretty? Why do the neighbor kids have all the nice toys? It's so easy when we look around to think God is somehow withholding from us if he doesn't give us the stuff we want when we want it. We might even begin to think we deserve those things for all our service, our hard work, our zeal, our commitment, and yes, even our suffering. Look, what have we done for you, Lord? You kind of owe me. Surely we've earned more than we've received. We're mistaken in one significant point, however. Sometimes God does withhold material blessings from us, but when he does so, he is offering us something greater than the thing we're desiring. When God offers us more of himself through our lack, we're likely to get frustrated and angry and discontent. But here's the thing about discontentment. It doesn't come from lack. We think we're not content because we don't have enough, but that's not the reason. Discontent comes from an ingratitude for what we actually have. We're not thankful for what we do have, and so we're envious or we're coveting what others may have. It grows out of this seed of an unmet expectation, an expectation that we ourselves set. Again, we want God to provide what we want in the manner and in the time we want it. And if he holds out on us, the incredible thing in all this, though, is God calls us to be like him in generosity. And generosity is a significant weapon we have against bitterness and envy. When we give, whether it's financial resources or of our possessions or our most precious resource of all, our time, when we give our time to others, whether it's helping them move or spending time praying with them or sharing a meal with them, We fight against ingratitude and bitterness. When we do this, we can overcome a lack of generosity, and we can, in fact, become more like Jesus. Understanding God's generosity properly only has one response, one right response, and that is worship. Generosity doesn't make comparisons. Generosity doesn't foster an attitude of entitlement or pride. Generosity doesn't seek recognition. Receiving God's generosity lights the fire of worship in a believer's life. The response then is to worship, but it's also to demonstrate that same generosity that we have received. Look, if you've ever received financial help from others, look for ways to be generous to those in need. There are often those in need in our church. It is a great privilege to be able to help one another. We can also help those outside the church. I find it very interesting that we just so happen to be in a text on a fifth Sunday. When months that have five Sundays, we collect a benevolence offering in God's kindness. But we also have another opportunity that we as a church can participate in, an opportunity for generosity over these next several weeks. Right across the street from us, right there on the corner of Spencer and Plainfield, is an organization called St. Gianna's No-Cost Baby Boutique. They give away diapers and clothing and strollers and all kinds of things. They have free lactation counseling for young moms. On July 30, they're shutting down our street. It's a Wednesday night, it's fifth Wednesday in July, and they're having their top-off-the-truck event. They are collecting diapers between now and then. They want to fill this tractor trailer with diapers. It's an amazing ministry, all at no cost. Probably the most incredible thing is, like Boaz with Ruth, they offer the poor great dignity when they receive charity. If you ever look inside it, it looks like a high-end consignment shop rather than a Goodwill on a Saturday evening. You know what I'm talking about. Over these next few Sundays, let's together bring in diapers of all sizes. We are one of their collection locations so that they have sufficient diapers to give to their clients. It's a practical way for us as a church to be generous together. But if you've received God's generosity in other ways, perhaps through the sharing of spiritual gifts in his body, look for ways you can serve others with your gifts. It doesn't just have to be money. If you've received an encouraging word, be generous with your words. Encourage people. Be grace-filled in your speech. Avoid criticism. If you've been comforted, offer comfort to those who are hurting. If you've learned something in Scripture, share that thing with someone. Be generous as you have received generosity. What enables this is because in a few minutes, we are going to serve communion to one another. We have yet another gift from the Lord, one that is physically tangible gift that demonstrates God's generosity. For in this meal we share together every week, God invites sinners to eat with him, a meal that only he can provide. God invites us to join with him in taking some of that bread and dipping it into the wine, so to speak. In this meal, we discover there is nothing God would truly withhold from us. For he has given us his body and his blood that we might be reconciled to him. God has shared all things with us in Christ. Whether he slaughters all his cattle on a thousand hills for us or not, he has given us himself. Giving us himself is not merely a lot. It is everything.